Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm. I'm joined with my good friend, Doug Hayren. Hey, Doug.
Hey, Kirk. How you doing? Happy Good Friday and Easter weekend to you.
We also have our tax tip expert here of the week, Kelly Coughlin. Hey, Kelly.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me. Doug, good to see you again.
We've got an extra, 11 days until tax season ends, till the deadline. So what do we got here, Kelly? What's the tip of the week?
Well, I think the tip of the week is going to be, doesn't apply to a ton of people out there, but if it does apply to you, lucky for you, it's dealing with restricted stock units and the taxation thereof. There's some discussion, people say, why do I have to pay twice on my taxes? Is it double tax? And it isn't true. But to simplify it, there are two ways it gets taxed. One, when it comes in, it becomes vested. That becomes, it's included in your W-2 at that point. You don't really have to worry about that. Your employer will take care of that part of it. And as long as it sits there, if you don't do anything, you're good to go. Nothing's going to happen. Then the next event occurs is when you sell that RSU. I don't want to get into details on that, but try to go long term on that. And it's 2 years from when it vests and 1 year from when you get it. So go long term on that. And then when that comes through, normally that gets that transaction, that sale transaction gets executed through the broker that is selected by the company to take care of their stock purchase plan, their RSUs, their ESP, employee stock purchase plan, that sort of thing. Could be E-Trade, could be Schwab. E-Trade's a big player in this market. So when E-Trade gets that transaction, by example, and you sell it, they don't see the original purchase. Like when you buy a stock at E-Trade, for instance, you buy IBM, they see the buy, they have that cost basis. They see the sell, you sold that through them. But when E-Trade, for instance, gets that sale, all they kind of see is the stock that comes in that's long in the account. And they don't see the original purchase because that was kind of done off balance sheet, you might say. You need to make sure that when you sell that RSU, that basis, I'm looking at a client of mine right here, filed his tax return. I didn't file this. He filed his tax return that showed zero basis on that stock. And that's inaccurate. So it came in as a zero cost on $250,000 in shares. That created one heck of a tax liability. It was inaccurate. We had to amend the return, get it cleaned up. No big deal there. I got paid a fee to do that. It's a great deal. So make sure that when you sell that RSU, that basis isn't zero. Chances are it's not zero. And if you don't know what the basis is, find out from the company that got it, the registrar, the transfer agent that takes care of that. That's my tax tip.
I can tell you that I've come across that a lot. It is a frequent problem where you get incorrect cost basis. And I think it was 10 years ago that the brokers didn't even include that on the summary statements to the IRS, but now they include it. And so if it's wrong, it's a huge problem. Whereas before, it was blank and you made it up. There was no tying it together.
If I could add one final point, is normally what they'll issue is a supplemental, a stock plan transactions supplement. If you have RSUs, wait for that supplement. And that sometimes can come a month later. I'm looking at this one. It came about a month later. So wait for that transaction supplement. If you don't have it, don't file your tax return. Get an amended, file an extension, whatever, right? Because you'll just overpay there.
Awesome. We'll definitely have you on next week. It'll probably be the last time before taxes are filed, but I know I'm getting a lot of positive feedback from your advice because people are just looking for advice this time of year. So thanks again for joining us and happy Good Friday, happy Easter.
Peace and love.
Peace and love. Doug, you probably know how much this applies because it happens to you all the time. I know it does to me.
Well, we've got some clients who have got some long-held stock that they've acquired over the years. You talked about when brokers started reporting it. Pros and cons. Before they started reporting it, It was kind of a pain in the butt for clients to figure out, like, what do I do? Your tax advisor would ask, what do I need to do here? What's the cost basis? Like, there's a lot of ways you can do it. You could try first in, first out. You could do average basis. The IRS gave you a lot of wiggle room there. And as long as you pretty much weren't reporting anything, unless it was legitimate, there wasn't really much that they came back to argue because they didn't have the information either. And what really made it tough back then is a broker might have a cost basis, but then you switch brokers and go to a different broker and it didn't go with them. So it's like, well, you had to go back to your old broker from, you know, three times ago to figure out what their cost basis was. It was a mess. So there are some areas, I've said this before, where some standardization and regulation can help. This is one of those. So if you bought a stock at $10 a share, it went to 25, and then you moved from, you know, let's say Morgan Stanley over to Ameriprise and it went back down to 15, and then you moved over to LPL and it went back up to 30, and then you sold it. It's like, well, what was it? Well, that $10 basis you bought it at before dividends now came with you. It got transferred to Ameriprise. It got transferred to LPL. And it doesn't give you a lot of flexibility, but it certainly makes things easier. The other thing I wanted to add, just based on the timing, it is April 7th. We've got April 15th, but I believe because the now every annual holiday, I believe that the actual tax day is the following Monday. But one of the things that you have, you know, again, this is kind of a simple tax planning concept, but not everybody out there is familiar with this. But you have up until tax filing with no extension to be able to fund IRAs for 2022. And this is important because you can fund a traditional IRA, which again, depending on your income tax bracket, you may be able to take a deduction on that, even though you're taking it, you might be contributing to a qualified plan at work. Many families will contribute to a qualified plan at work and will not be able to take a deduction on an IRA contribution, which leaves the Roth IRA option. Roth IRA option, it doesn't matter. The IRS looks at IRAs as a max amount, whether it's traditional or Roth. Here's the thing. A lot of people say, well, I can't fund a Roth, right? I can't afford it. Or maybe I make too much money to put money into a Roth IRA. And so there is an option that you can do. You can actually fund an IRA every year, regardless of your income. It's called, and you can actually do it as a non-deducted contribution. You work with your tax advisor to file a form for that, for the basis. You don't take a tax deduction on it. And if you don't have any regular traditional IRA assets right now, even if you have a high income and don't regularly qualify for a Roth IRA, you can put this money in as an after-tax non-deducted contribution into a regular IRA account. And guess what you can do later? You can convert that to a Roth. So there are people that have referred to this as a backdoor Roth funding. I don't want to get into trouble. Step transactions here with the IRS. Talk to your tax advisor about what that means. But the key is if you make too much money to fund a Roth IRA, you can still potentially fund a Roth IRA by funding a non-deducted IRA first. And you still have until tax filing to do it for 2022. Now, last year, if you were under the age of 50, you could fund $6,000 per person. Over the age of 50, it was seven. Now for 2023, it goes up to $6,500 if you're under the age of 50 and $7,500 if you're over the age of 50. What does that mean? If you're a couple, you can fund 2 years of this together. So if you're over the age of 50, that is $14,000 for 2022 and it's $15,000 for 2023. That means right now you could fund $29,000. And again, if you do this as a non-deducted contribution and convert it later, that is $29,000 either directly into a Roth or through a conversion process, $29,000 into tax-free accounts. Now, if you wait until after tax filing, you're going to lose the ability to fund as much as $14,000. It's going to drop down to $15,000. So if you're trying to get money away for tax planning and you want to have a really simple way to get money into a tax-free account, you have up until tax filing to potentially put as much as $29,000 away. Now do that, do the math on that over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years. That adds up really quickly.
That's why I love Doug. He's so smart. We don't talk a lot about planning on this show. You know, it's mostly investment related, economic related, and we have some great guests on the show, but the planning element is really where, you know, you get the dirty details done. You know, you get into the numbers. There's so many different pathways that, you know, can be used to save people money. I know from a college perspective, and I'm going to pitch Doug for a minute here so he doesn't have to, because it's Good Friday and I'm feeling pretty good today. So, you know, when it comes to college, if you can save somebody $20,000, $50,000 on their expenses to college, that's pretty nice. It doesn't matter what college you're getting into, and you can't do that for every college, of course. But if you're looking at two colleges that are identical and one costs, you know, $50,000, the other costs $20,000, you're going to feel pretty good about the $20,000 if they're identical, more or less identical. The cost of college is getting out of control nowadays, and it's only going to get worse. So, you know, sometimes it's just the planning elements, even though it's boring and it's stodgy. And I don't like talking about it in the show because it puts people to sleep. So we're going to move on to more exciting topics like the world imploding. But when you get into the planning elements, there's so many things that can be done. And this is what I love about this field, is that it's not just one big stamp. Oh, everybody fits in this bucket. It's like, no, you got this cool thing going on here and this cool thing over here. Let's see how we can blend it together and save you some money and try to help you pay less taxes. Like, this to me, I'm not going to speak for Doug, but this to me is a lot of fun, because it's like, all right, where can we thread the needle and you know, help this family save better for retirement? So this is what I love about it. Doug had all the fun today. So we're going to move on to topics that are going to be fun for me.
I'm just going to layer one thing onto that, Kirk. And that is, I think there's, and don't quote me on this, but there's something like 90 some ways in the U.S. tax code on how you have to pay taxes. There's like 20,000 things in the U.S. tax code how to avoid them. That's what makes this fun, is our tax system is actually built to start at a certain level of taxation and go down from there. You know, a lot of people say, well, that, you know, a lot of these rules, these things, they're out there, they're just for people, the wealthy. This is not true. We're in America. Anybody can go out right now, start a business of any kind, and just right there begin taking advantage of any of those tax benefits. Anybody can go out there and buy a stock of a company that it gets railed in the news as being a corporation that gets all these tax breaks. And guess what? You can participate too. Go out and buy the stock. We have an incredible opportunity in our tax system, in our investment system, in our economy, for those that want to take advantage of it. There's no reason to sit back and complain. Jump in, get started. You can participate as well.
No, totally agree. So we're going to jump into some fun stuff here, which I wanted to kind of show this on the screen here, which is the MOVE Index, which effectively, for all intents and purposes, is the bond market equivalent of the VIX. And those of you who don't know the VIX is effectively a volatility index. It measures the volatility of stock market. So if you look at the VIX, some of the highest points it's ever gotten were 2008, during that period. And actually, I think it just touched the highest point in 2020. I forget the number, it was like 83 or something like that. But it was like the highest it ever got. It touched the same point as before and came back down. But the point of all this is, when the VIX is high, it means there's higher perceived risk and higher perceived volatility in the stock market. And when it's low, it means that kind of all is quiet, the waters are calm, hey, it's safe to come in. And that's kind of how people look at the VIX. And I don't want to get too technical. The VIX has a lot of applications in options and other things. But the simple way is to look at it as, low is good for the stock market, high is bad. Bad meaning that things are going wrong. I mention it because the MOVE Index is the bond equivalent of the VIX, which means that it's basically measuring the implied volatility of the one-month options from the two-year to the 30-year. It is one of the highest it's ever been. As of 315, it was 198. Right now, it's only 153. Well, 198 was, I think the highest was 264 in 2008. In 98, I think it was, it hit 195. So it went a little bit higher than that. And the lockdown only went to 163. I just mentioned these things for reference. But if you look at the chart, so if you go on LinkedIn, if you go on the website, or if you go on YouTube, you'll see the visuals here of what the MOVE Index is. So there's got some peaks and some points, but you know, the lockdown pandemic, you know, the peak, it was lower than it was about 20 days ago. And right now it's just below that. It's still really high. Now, what does this mean? I mean, we've been talking about taxes, now we're talking about the VIX, probably boring people to tears here, Doug. But the reason that I bring it up is that what we're measuring is what is going on. What is going on in the bond market? Because people don't talk about the bond market. They don't care about the bond market. Most people don't understand the bond market. They don't want to know about the bond market. Bond market is like, it's like going to a banker's convention pre-2008. It's just a snooze fest. There's nothing to talk about. There's nothing exciting. But people don't like bonds because they're boring. I love bonds because they're boring. I love fixed income. We do a lot of private mortgages. We get really good rates and it's boring. Oh, what happened in the stock market? Don't care. Making my 1% a month or whatever it is. Like, I'm happy. I don't care what's going on in the stock market. Like, bond people are different. They don't care about the fluctuations in the stock. They care about, am I going to get my interest and am I going to get my principal back? That's all they care about. Now, from my standpoint, I look at bonds and say, well, am I getting my principal back? Yeah, that's important. What's the interest rate? Well, the interest rate has stunk for the last 10, 20 years, not 20 years, maybe 15 years. The interest rates have stunk. Now they're getting attractive again. A little over 5% on the short term on the treasuries. Now we're down to 4.6, 4.7. We got up as high as 5.3 right before SVB kind of blew up the system. The important takeaway is this. The bond market is supposed to be boring. Right now, it's not boring. Right now, it's really volatile. I'll bring this back to impress upon everybody the importance of this. So bonds were trading right before the SVB Thursday, the Thursday before that weekend with SVB and Signature Bank, where they kind of imploded over the weekend. That Thursday beforehand, short-term treasuries, this is anything under 1 year, were as high as 5.3%. That was the high point. And then the yields just started to decline because the rumors got out there and SVB got taken over the FDIC and so did Signature Bank. And then bond rates went down. They declined. They went down to, I think, 4.2, 4.3, maybe 4.25, I think is probably right around the low point. So the short-term bonds went down there. So they went down a full percent in a matter of a few days. That is enormous volatility. That's crazy volatility. That is, I mean, this is where it hit like one of the highest points it's ever got. It went above long-term capital management. It went above the pandemic. It went above everything except for the TARP bailout. The TARP bailout was higher. Other than that, it was the highest, which means there's something wrong. It shouldn't happen, okay? It did happen. It may happen again, but it shouldn't happen in normal times. What does this mean? This means we're not in normal times. I don't care what the stock market's doing. What's smarter, Doug, the stock market or the bond market?
Bond market has historically been a very clear, telltale mathematical indicator of things that are going on. The stock market is full of emotion, excitement, and ultimately stupidity. Although I will say the bond market has been full of stupidity too, at least the people that have been trading it, banks. But anyway.
We're not naming any names, SVB. So that's really important, okay? You talk to anybody on Wall Street, even the equity traders will say the same thing. The smart money is the bond market. The stock market is the dumb money. It has always been the case. It always will be the case. Like you said, emotion. Stocks are driven by emotion. Bonds are not. Bonds are driven by numbers. Is there emotion? Sure. There's always emotion everywhere. But the bond market is basically run by engineers, quants and math geeks and people like that, that you could argue most of them don't have emotions. I don't want to paint them with a negative brush, but they're really good at numbers and they're really good at staying away from the emotion.
Some of the smartest economists out there in the investment industry, it's funny because I know some of them and they have been painted as perma bear or perma bull or this and that. Listen, the best people in the industry started in the bond world. They started in fixed income because that's where you have to cut your teeth and really look at things black and white.
Yeah. And to that point, the reason the bond market is the smart money, I'm poking a little fun at my bond market friends a little bit without emotion, but it's the nature. They're the smart money. They are the place you go if you want to make real money on Wall Street. For many reasons, I won't get into all of them. The people there are making the smart decisions. So if you see a divergence in the stock market and the bond market, what's the natural assumption? Well, one of them's wrong. Well, which one? If I had to flip a coin, if I had no idea, I'd say the bond market. They're not always 100% right. I'm just going to be clear. They're not 100% right. But if I was going to choose stock market or bond market, I would say it's the bond market because the bond market is the smart money and they're the slow money and they're methodical and they make better decisions. So when you start to see volatility in the bond market, what that means to me is there's a lot of uncertainty in the direction of bonds and yields and inflation. And this comes back to the point we make over and over and over again on this show, which is the stock prices and bond prices are future expectations. Stock prices, future expectations of about 6 months. So if stocks are going up, people are assuming in the next 6 months, then the economic conditions are going to improve. Stocks are going down, it means they're going to deteriorate over the next 6 months, about 6 months from now. That's generally the trend. It's not today. It doesn't matter what happened in the news today. if somebody bombed another country, if Russia bombed another country like France, yeah, you'd probably see the markets drop because they're assuming 6 months from now, there's going to be a lot more problems and the economy is going to implode and all that. That's what they're pricing in. They're not pricing in what happened today. They're trying to price in what's going to happen 6 months from now. And obviously they can't tell the future, but if you look at the numbers, the bonds are trying to predict where yields and inflation are going to go 6 months from now or a year from now. Well, what's the probability of that happening? Well, Doug and I have been talking a lot in this show. We think that Wall Street has it completely wrong on inflation. And the reason we say that is you could say, well, the bond market is the smart money, but who controls the bond market? The Fed. The Fed controls the bond market because the Fed says we're doing this, the bond market's going to follow. So the bond market may be smart, but the Fed would be God. You know, what they say rules. It doesn't matter if they're wrong. You know, we could argue to the blue in the face that the Fed is wrong, but it doesn't matter. What matters is the price. The price is the final arbiter of truth, is what is the price. So let's wrap this all the way back, okay? The Fed dictates direction of the bond market. The bond market dictates the direction of the stock market and dictates, you know, the economy. That's how you should look at it. That's not exactly how it happens, but that's how you should look at it. So if we look at this, bond prices are still volatile. So they went down to about 4.25 in the short end, and then they're up to like 4.7, I think, as of yesterday. That's a huge range of movement. And at the same time, the Fed is still out there saying, hey, we're going to keep pushing into recession. We're not in a recession yet. We saw some few signs a few days ago, but that's not enough to start a tidal wave. And is inflation coming down? Well, we'll find out soon enough. It's at 6% still.
I think the Fed came out and said that the recession is transitory, Kirk.
Everything's transitory. I wish the Fed was transitory, Doug.
Exactly.
I'd make a lot of my friends happy if they found that out. But look, to wrap this whole point up, here's the thing. Right now, the Federal Reserve has more or less said and has been saying for a long time, they haven't explicitly said this, but I think based on all the Fed governors, everyone coming out, 5 to 5.5% is approximately where the Fed funds rate should be. I think they're going to try to raise it a little bit more. They went 25 basis points recently. If the market doesn't fall apart and the world doesn't implode, I think they're going to try to get another 25 to 50. I think that's reasonable. And if they get to that point and inflation still, I think inflation may come down to 5.5. So they might meet it right there. And if they're equal, that would actually be a good thing for the Fed. That's not going to cause it to drop, but at least it'll give the economy a chance to decline a little bit more. Now, that's not good for mortgage rates, not good for anything else, but for the short term, it should help moderate inflation or at least keep it in check. Now, whether that takes off again, you know, we talk about a lot of this show, the bullwhip effect, but for the moment, it seems to be keeping things relatively in check. And I think that's the marker. So this volatile bond index is basically the bond market not deciding whether rates are going to start dropping and we're going to pivot. When you talk about the pivot on the show, the pivot is nonsensical. There's no pivot. People think of the pivot as we're going to stop raising rates. It's not. The pivot is when you start dropping rates. And I think we're a long way away from there. So the people who think we're going to drop rates in the next 6 months are fooling themselves. It's very unlikely it's going to happen. Maybe next year, who knows? Depends if the stock market falls apart. But at the moment, they're going to keep rates where they are. And I think they're going to keep rates where they are longer than most people think. And I think that because unless we have an implosion in the economy and economic indicators and all of the other things that they look at, they're going to keep rates where they are because it's not bad. There's no reason to lower rates at this point. The only reason is if banks are going to fall apart, but even then they're more or less bailing those people out. The people are making stupid decisions. So understand the bond market, understand the indicators like the MOVE Index. I think it's a really important factor.
Hey, Doug, did you hear? We're giving away free money. Well, I'll tell you about it in a bit. There's a saying in the mining community. Well, precious metals mining, that is. The saying is that if you want the best deals, you have to be in the room. Now, you're probably thinking, what does it mean to be in the room? Well, I'll tell you. Being in the room means that you're on the short list of people who get invited to be a part of the best deals. These are the deals that most investors will never have access to. You mean like IPOs? Nope. IPOs are chump change. Those are for retail investors, small potatoes. That's nothing compared to these deals. These deals would have you salivating to get access to them. Once you know they exist, you will never look at investing the same way again. I almost don't want to tell you they exist because it'll ruin your thinking of how the investing world really works. Now, you might be excited that these deals exist, but you only have access to the deals if you're an insider or in the room, as they call it. As loyal listeners of the show, I'm going to give you a chance to be in the room. Money Tree Investing Podcast has created the Insiders Club. This is a community of our show's members who are loyal listeners of the show and want to get more out of their investing experience. Being a part of the Insiders Club gives you insider status for upcoming events and private webinars, discounts, free stuff and books, and influence on the future direction of the show. This is an opportunity to join us as we expand our content and services. Oh, did I mention you're getting free money? Yes, in the next few weeks, I will be giving free money to members of the Insiders Club as my appreciation for listening to the show. There's no cost to join the Insiders Club. Just go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money. Do that today to join the community. That's moneytreepodcast.com/free money. I hope to see you in the room.
Let's head into some other topics, Doug. Anything you want to hit on before we get into correlation versus causation, which I think is really important?
One thing I'm starting to see right now, again, watch on the bond market side of things. And again, we're not here to give advice or trading, but it can give you some real good indicators as to kind of where things are going to go. You know, bonds, we talk about the steadiness of it. You talked about how it's mathematical. You talked about how bond traders are kind of a different beast. They don't look for those gains. I've talked about that here before, that there is more to be gained by avoiding losses than picking winners. Some of the greatest wealth in the history of the world has been based off of banking. And banking is all about fixed interest. As a matter of fact, the biggest problems that we've run into, and I talked about this in our last couple of calls, is when they got into blending and muddying the rules between traditional commercial type of lending and investment banking. Because what happened is the investment banks get into that speculation. The investment banks get into that emotion. We go back to The Big Short. Again, the emotion. We've caught up in this real estate. We think this is the way to go. We don't want to get out of this. Oh my gosh, you know, the world is going to go up. How many people invest based on emotion? If you go back and you really look at the volatility, we talk about the 13 years the S&P 500 was flat to negative. You go back and look at what the average return of the S&P 500 has been since 1999. We finally got back to a point before 2022 in which it was just finally broke and surpassed a 5 to 6% flat interest rate. What bond traders understand is they want that interest rate. And again, they want a good interest rate, but they want their principal back. They're not trying to see their principal get to any significant elevated levels. Matter of fact, when there's more volatility on trading the principal in bonds, the more trading that's going on in bonds, the more risk and more problems there ends up being. The ideal situation for most bond traders is I know predictably what I'm going to get. And if I can get 4, 5, 6, 7, 8% every single year, especially when we start getting past 5%, if you can exceed 5% on a regular basis mathematically, it is probably long-term one of the best places you can get and put your money. Because unfortunately, while the markets may exceed and get 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, all it takes is a year or two here and there where they lose 20 to 30 and you are never making up. This is rule number one, compound interest. A lot of people confuse compound interest to what they're getting in their portfolios. That's compound appreciation. And it's not even compounding because it goes back and forth all the time. Compound interest means here's the money, it's yours. We can never take it back. And compound interest, again, going back to Albert Einstein and a lot of really smart people, is the eighth wonder of the world. And where is it the eighth wonder of the world? Continuously compound interest. So if you're putting your money in and pulling it out and putting your money in and pulling it out, then you really can't count on the power of compound interest. It doesn't work, but people forget the continuous. So just a little segue there of why the bond market, of course, is a great indicator, but also just steady, consistent interest-based returns when there is actually interest. We're not talking about the point, I don't know what, evaporated money in your bank account. I'm talking real compounding interest. Ultimately, mathematically, is an incredible force to wealth.
I'm going to read a quick quote. Every once in a while, I see these things in the news and I call them absurd things that make you think. All right, so here's an absurd thing to make you think. By the end of this century, the UN projects that Africa will be home to 3.9 billion people or 40% of humanity. Now, I read that and immediately I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But when you dig further, it's like, yeah, if trends continue on the same direction forever, which they don't, then yeah, maybe that would be possible. I mean, right now we've got 8 billion people, and I guess that means 10 billion by the end or whatever that is. But I see these things, I'm like, really? Is that the direction it's going? Is it possible? Absolutely, it's possible. But to me, numbers don't always make sense. But people tend to take a number and then they reflect that number's growth into the future indefinitely and say, well, if trends go on forever, then it's going to look like X. Well, if trends go on forever and Africa is the fastest growing continent in the world, then at some point they're going to have 99.99% of the global population if trends went on forever. But of course, that doesn't happen. That's silly. But it's the same line of thinking, right? When people say, well, according to these trends, then this country is going to be, you know, like China is going to have 10 bazillion people by the end of the century. Well, that's absurd to think about, but that's the line of thinking, right? They project it on forever and say, if this happens, then all these other things are going to happen. But that's not how it works because we live in one big ecosystem. The thing about ecosystems is it doesn't work in one direction. They balance. If it gets too populated, there'll probably be wars over resources, which will kill off a lot of people, which means the growth won't continue. So there's things that happen that kind of self-regulate the trends. But I think it's just important to note because I saw that and I was like, all right, well, I need to call this out. I can't let this go by without calling it out.
If you think about Africa, they're already struggling with a lot of those. The ecosystem is already struggling to support. I mean, it is a large swath of the entire continent is desert, not sandy desert, but low moisture desert. So think of the number of examples just in our lifetime. And some of this is politically motivated based off of, you know, the regimes in power, but famine, starvation, drought, suffocation. It's a very harsh place in general. So I think there's a lot that's going to be impacting there. The one thing I do want to add about Africa, though, if you really look at the size of it, it's absolutely massive as a continent. And the one thing that Africa really has, it is certainly something to keep an eye on, is the number of natural resources that are available out of that continent. It is, without question, at least as far as we know, the single most concentrated source of critical raw materials for our planet of anywhere else on dry land. That's going to make it a continual, always a continual impact on global economy.
So that's a great point, Doug. And I think given the world we live in, where there's an increasing fight over resources, if you look at, you know, the U.S. has been kind of the world police for a long time, and it's given us a lot of power to control the global resources in many ways. You know, if you look at lithium, which we're basically mining in other countries because it's too dangerous to mine here, and yet everybody wants electric cars, but it requires
lithium. It's green, Kirk. It's green energy. It's very good, safe, no pollution, wonderful. Lithium's excellent for us.
Well, it's not dirty, Doug, because it doesn't happen where I can see it. So it's got to
be
clean.
Oh, it's not in your backyard. Oh,
okay. Yes. Yeah, NIMBY.
That explains NIMBY a lot.
NIMBY. Us Massachusetts people like our not in our backyard kind of things.
I wasn't going to say it, Kirk. You took that turn and went down the rest of the road. Thank you very much.
So you're welcome. So let's get to this chart, though. I want to talk about the concept. This is where you get into mental frameworks. And I think it's a good episode because, you know, we're a little light on news today because the markets are shut down. So let's talk about a mental framework that will carry over for everything when it comes to finance. And the framework is this: correlation versus causation. Now, many years ago, this person, I forget his name, I want to give him credit, he was just wonderful. He did this study on correlation versus causation. And he took totally unrelated things and showed a high correlation, like amount of honeybee colonies and pot smokers, or amount of margarine eaten and divorces, which, you know, may have some correlation. But
heart attacks, Kirk? Oh, wait, no, that one is correlated. Sorry.
Yeah, that one's correlated. Yes. But the point is the difference between correlation and causation is really important. And I say this because people frequently confuse the two and they look at it and say, well, these two are similar. They must be causative. Well, correlation is this. You take one thing and you take another thing, totally unrelated. And you take these two things, and the example might be juveniles smoking pot, and it might be honeybee colonies. Totally unrelated as far as I can tell. Now, is it correlated or causative that these things are related, right? If you look at a chart and the charts look exactly the same, you can put them on top of each other and they look identical. You say, well, they must be causative. No, they're correlated. And these things happen. Sometimes there are correlations. And the correlations might look so similar, you might think there must be a connection. No, there doesn't need to be a connection. There might be, but it doesn't need to be. There are plenty of things in nature and in our society that are correlated, but not causative. Now, causative would be something different, right? It might be driving drunk has a causative effect of getting arrested or getting in an accident or doing other harmful things. That's a causation. That's an obvious causation. People are inebriated. They don't drive as well, so they get into accidents. That's a causative effect. The causative effect may not be 100%, right? Because some people drive drunk and they never cause accidents. So it's not 100% causative, but there's a high enough correlation and causation in there that you could say, yes, this makes a lot of sense. Now, this is a more obvious example, but there's less obvious examples. I only point that out just to kind of like paint the field as to how you should think about it. But let's dive right in. Let's look at some real life examples so that you can actually use this mental framework to apply it to other things. Here's one. There's a bunch of charts that we have here. So this is something that Wall Street tends to do. They tend to look at history and say, well, this is typical of history. So here's what you should expect. Is it correlation or causation? It is correlation. It is not causation. There might be causative effects in there, but you can't tell the future. If you could, everyone would make lots of money and they wouldn't be telling you about it. They'd be living on an island just printing money in their basement. So here's one. It's called the pre-election years tend to bottom in late February. So there's this election cycle, a four-year election cycle for president that people tend to follow. Certain years, and we'll get into that in the next chart, but basically certain years tend to do well and certain parts of other years do well and some don't do well. So here's the pre-election year or the year prior to the election year. Look at here. Oh, February, things are flat and they bottom in March and then they start to go up until the end of May. And then you have this rule of thumb, which is sell in May and go away, which basically means that all of the Wall Street traders, they sell all their positions and they go live in the Hamptons and they come back in the fall. That is the adage. And that used to happen 100 years ago. Does it happen anymore? Sort of, but there's still plenty of people around that trade. So it's not like nothing happens. But according to this, this would lead you to believe that pretty much from March, April, and May, it's a great time to be in the market. The market's just going to go gangbusters. And from January to some parts of February, it also does really well. But then the summer, it kind of flatlines and then it's flat until December and then it takes off. That's what this chart will lead you to believe. Is this going to be true going forward? Well, I don't know. It depends. This is basically an average year returns for the S&P 500. So this is one example. I don't know if it's true. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Here's another example. This is saying that two strong months are coming up, March and April. Are they going to be strong months? I don't know. But historically, this is how it's calculated. This is since 1950. One of the bars is since 1950, the past 20 years, past 10, and then all pre-election years. So this is just show the data. So what they're doing here is they're showing you data and they're leading you to believe that you should stay invested in March and April. That is the message they're trying to convey to you. So I want you for a moment to disconnect the message from reality. We all know about narrative. If you watch the news, you know what a narrative is. The news is 100% narrative nowadays. It has nothing to do with truth or fact or anything like that. It's all about the narrative they're trying to promote. This is both parties do the same thing. All news is the same. It's a narrative. So this is a narrative that is being put in front of you. The narrative is March and April are a great time to invest. So put all your money in the market. Are you going to see them talk about May and June? No, no one's going to be pushing this chart in May and June. We might, but no one else is going to be pushing this chart in May and June. They're not going to be promoting this is a bad time to be in the market. August and September, also bad times to be in the market. No one's going to be telling you that. Why? Because they want you to be invested. Wall Street wants you to be invested all the time. That's where they make their money. And if you take your money out and put it in a bank or you get CDs or whatever, they're not going to make as much money. So they don't want you to do that. So it's always buy, buy, buy. The narrative is always look at how great things are going to be. This is not causative. This is correlation. Yes, in these months, things tend to happen this way for specific reasons. Is it going to happen this year? I don't know. But you should be aware that it's not truth. It is a narrative. Here's another one. The S&P 500 four-year election cycle. So this is what I was talking about before. It shows the year right after a president gets elected. That's the first chunk, the post-election. Then there's midterm, which is the second year of the presidential term. Then there's the third year, which is pre-election. And then the fourth year, which is election. So what this is leading you to believe is that the midterm year is crappy. Oh, well, how convenient, because the market sold off a lot during that year. Well, it really had nothing to do with the election. The market selling off had nothing to do with Biden. It had nothing to do with the midterm. Absolutely nothing. It had to do with so many other things that had nothing to do with the politics. But people are showing you this chart. They're like, wow, look at this. It's because of that that this is happening. But you know what? Pre-election cycle, it's going to do great. Look at the great performance we're going to get in the pre-election cycle. Is that going to happen? I don't know. I know that what's going on right now has really nothing to do with the pre-election cycle. What's going on right now has to do with inflation, has to do with the Fed, has to do with Ukraine, has to do a lot of things, but it really has very little to do with the election cycle. But people are going to point to this because, as it says in the chart, more upside left, it's not too late. I didn't put that in there. These people put that in there. And then the point is they're trying to promote a narrative. And the narrative is, look at all this opportunity you're going to get over the next, 9 months. It's going to be great. You're going to make tons of money. That's the narrative. Now, is it true? I don't know. Maybe it is. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying understand the narrative. The narrative on this is that the market's going to go up. We're in the sweet spot. Everything's going to do great. No one's going to have any problems. Party time. It's 1999. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's what this chart is telling you to think. Let's look at another one. Trading days of the year. Here's another thing Wall Street tends to do. Let's compare another random year where it has a chart, a trading day chart, the days of the year of the S&P 500 or another index. Let's compare that chart to one of today, and let's find one that maps as closely as possible to it, and that will somehow convince everybody the rest of the year is going to look very similar. Think of how absurd that is. Hey, Doug, in 1923, this is a chart of 1923, and look, this year is 2023. The charts look so similar, Doug. Wow. Can you imagine the returns were? It's going to be up 30% by the end of the year, according to this chart that was 100 years ago. Well, it must be the same because it ends in 23. It's got to.
Put all your money on 00. That roulette wheel is spinning money, baby. Bring it on.
Right. I mean, I flipped a head 9 times in a row. So what's the odds it's going to be head? Well, it's got to be 90%. I'm going to get heads again. That's the kind of silliness that goes on. But people look at it. And I don't fault anybody listening because we all are susceptible to this, including myself, including Doug. And this is something you have to constantly fight over and over again. You have to look at things with a fresh set of eyes, because if you don't, you're going to get caught up in this. I look at this and I'm like, yeah, it looks pretty convincing. Yeah, it looks like we're probably going to get a good next 45 days. Next 45 days are going to be great. Look at that. But the point is, this is something that happens over and over again. These traders and quants, they look at the past and they say, ooh, there's some similarities. Let's follow this. It's totally ridiculous because the past is not the same as the future. It might be similar, but it's not going to be the same. And if you have enough people thinking it's similar and the same, then it might actually become the same. The market is nothing more than a reflection of human emotions and behaviors. It is just a behavior mechanism. It's reflective of human behavior. So if enough people do it, it will happen. It is self-reinforcing, or what was the word we used, Doug, last week? Oh, reflexivity. Reflexivity is an action causing the reaction, right? If there's inflation and people think there's inflation, they will cause inflation, which will in effect cause inflation. Deflation, the same thing. So the cause and effect. Are you afraid of the thing? And is that thing causing the thing to happen? That's reflexivity. So if enough people think that, but not enough people are silly to follow this. There's only a handful of people that do. But it is convincing, right? It's going to convince you, hey, I should stay in the market because look at that upside I'm going to miss. Or here's another one. This year, what it looks like compared to the average year. Well, this doesn't look anything like the average year. I don't know about you, Doug, but this year does not look anything like that. Is it going to be like the average year? I don't know. But based on this, I'm not using it as a comparison. But I put this in here because I thought, what a great way to show the silliness of comparing one year to an average year or another year. It looks nothing like it. But for whatever reason, they're promoting this as a narrative, or here's what you should think about. It's not sell it, because right now, kind of where we are, it's a little bit above. So maybe you got to wait and, oh, it'll continue going higher. I think the trend is similar. January tends to be a good month till about mid-February, and March is slow, and then April and May tend to do well. That is normal. But I just want to point out the silliness of comparing years, because most years is just ridiculous. There's no comparison. Here's another one, and I'm going to give it back to Doug. I don't want to hog the mic the whole time. But here's another one I thought was brilliant. It's comparing the S&P 500 to 1965, 1944, 2009, and 1947. Wow, look at the similarities, Doug. They look so similar. Maybe it's going to reflect each one. But actually, if you look at each one, you'll also realize that even though the charts are similar up till now, the future looks nothing like each other. So one of them is bound to be wrong, but one of them might be right, which means that, wow, I prognosticated the future, Doug, because I compared it to 1965. So if it happens that way, I was right. Even though I was wrong 3 times out of 4, I was right 1 time. So, hey, I was right. So I'll pick out that one right one and I'll promote it on social media. I'll say, look how right it was. This is another thing that happens, is people will be wrong a lot. If people talk about, I picked 20 of the last 10 recessions, Doug. That's just like a running joke on Wall Street. Oh, yeah, he's really smart. He picked 20 of the last 10 recessions, meaning it's always a recession. And when you're right, hey, look, I picked it. Well, yeah, because you picked it every other year. And so happened this year, you were right. So this happens a lot. So don't fall for this. This is another game that Wall Street plays where they try to put up a bunch of things and say, look, we predicted this and look at how similar it is. The similarities are ridiculous for going forward. Every single one is going to be different. It either says, I'll bet if you compare it to these 4 years, the market is going to either go up, it's going to go down, or it's going to go sideways. I guarantee it's going to go one of those three directions, Doug. And I don't know how I can be wrong at this point. What do you think?
Can it go backwards? You know, it's funny, the one that you showed a couple, back that was just completely different than the average. How does this compare to the average? Well, I mean, averages are made up. This is like climate versus weather right here. So the short green line is the weather. It's all over the place. The climate is the longer term trend line. But if you were trying to compare this year compared to another average year, it's telling me this year is completely and utterly get me the vomit bag. It's like, oh, it's doing great. Well, is it? Because it was. And now we're about to go off a cliff. I mean, all it's going to take, and this is what goes back to kind of summarizing our conversation today. So much of this is based off of predictions. And when those predictions are right, that's when they publish it. And so much of this is about trying to predict speculation. That's, again, going back, that's why the bond traders like the predictability of the bond market. That's why the bond market tells you a lot of things, because this right here is trying to tell you what something completely out of your control might do. And might do means it could be right, but could be wrong. And it's a lot harder to be right than wrong. I'm sorry. It's a lot harder to be right than wrong. As you said, hey, he predicted the recession 20 out of the 10 years. This is a reality of it. It also brings me to another thing that is a complete pet peeve of mine, is the way in which our industry and the clients, the customers, the average retail investor come together. Because what happens? You're either trying to do this on your own, and maybe you're not getting what returns you think you should be getting based on some arbitrary expectation. And then you look and you say, well, look at what they're doing over there. They're doing better. And by the way, here's the truth. Nobody likes to tell you what didn't go right. People love to tell you what did. So then you go and you say, well, I met with this other advisor. What did they do? They went back and showed you one of those 20 times that they predicted the recession that they were right 10 times, right? They say, look what we did. Look how we would have performed in the rearview mirror. We're amazing. They fit the numbers to fit their narrative. And then you're convinced that all of a sudden they must be better. And listen, it comes down to performance is not a way to gauge anything, because performance has so many other variables into it, including what is your risk tolerance? How much exposure to stocks versus bonds versus alternatives? What was your timing on getting in? What is your expectations if you were trying to get? Why are you concentrating on growth? These charts can be manipulated in so many ways. What really comes down to is you have to have a philosophy and a process. And what I respect a lot about people that are really focused on the stock world, or people that are really focused in the bond world, is they know what they know. Some of the most calm and disciplined clients that we've ever worked with are actually certified financial analysts. Now, they're really smart in what they know, but what they also have recognized in what they know is they know what they know and they don't know anything else. And because of that, they're willing to listen to advice and they're willing to take other types of information in. And they're also, they're disciplined enough to understand that the one thing that is completely out of any of our control is what the markets and the economy are going to do. And one thing that Kirk showed here in all of these charts is you can correlate as much as you want. and you can show all this different data. And the only thing that I saw on the 50 slides that you just showed, Kirk, is that it's all different and it's all over the place and we have no control over any of it. So that means from a planning standpoint, to bring this entire hour full circle, the best thing you can be doing is planning, putting a plan in, following a process, staying disciplined to that. And if you are, you will be successful. It's when you try to accomplish more than you should or need based on your plan, or you jump around changing your plans, or most importantly, you forget exactly why you're doing it in the first place and you drift away from what matters. You want more money, but why? What does that lead with more money? You could go get $200,000 a year more, but never see your family. Miss all those years with your kids. I heard a story, Kirk, when I was down in Arizona on a spring break. And we all know, everybody everywhere knows, that depending on where you are, there's labor challenges. And this gentleman was telling me how at their restaurant, he had a conversation with a guy who was going to take and leave the job to take another job that was going to pay him 30 cents an hour more. The other job he was taking, Kirk, was 3 hours away. So he was going to drive 3 hours each way for 30 cents an hour more. He never thought about the gas. He never thought about the quality of life. In the end, he's not only going to be financially in the red over the job he had, but he's going to also lose perspective on what matters to him in life. And that's what it comes down to with everything. Make sure you understand what matters to you, because if you really truly understand what matters, it will help you to make lots of decisions and it'll help you to stay within the process and the discipline, which, as all these charts show you, there's a lot of chaos out there in the world. There's a lot of chaos out there in the markets. But if you know what matters to you, you'll be able to get through all of it.
Great. Well, Doug, where can people find more about you?
Listen, if you've got a kid in high school, it's going to be going to college within, you know, the next 4 to 6 years, you have to be thinking about financial planning for college. You have to be thinking about how you're going to get that cost down. Come check out, download our free checklist for college at procollegeplanners.com. And if you have any questions, want to have a conversation, want to learn a little bit more, set up a 30-minute to 1 hour conversation. Be happy to talk to you about a lot of what you need to know for college, because there is one thing for sure, the college game is stacked against you. And if you're playing without the instructions, you're going to lose. And we can help you even that playing field. Procollegeplanners.com.
Well, Doug, thanks for joining us. We're going to wrap it up here. I just wanted to, since we got this chart on the screen, just wanted to say this chart is basically the S&P 500 returns around the start of the Fed hiking cycle. I only put this up, I didn't get too much time to explain it, but I put this up not because it's the lower end, but to really illustrate the fact that actually the returns and their Fed hiking cycle actually are very low causation. Now, we could talk about it next week because I think this is an excellent chart. I just wanted to mention it because this is one thing that is very commonly misunderstood and we don't have time to talk, so we'll mention it next week. I just wanted to plant the seeds for that conversation. So that's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth Manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please remember to subscribe to the podcast and the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube, so please check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment in the podcast app of your choice. Oh, and don't forget, do your own research. This show is for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. We're also not selling any products or services, so do not consider this advice. If you have any problems with the show, I blame Putin. Please send him an email and express your feelings. If you're seeking financial advice, talk to an oracle or a fortune teller, or maybe just talk to a licensed financial advisor. I'm one. As I said earlier, I'm not selling anything, but I'm easy to find. Have a great week ahead, and remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.